Welcome to the fourth podcast of Year of Wonders. We're going to be covering chapter 6, which is Wide Green Prison and So Soon to Be Dust. And if we've got time, we might actually get on to the Poppies of Leith as well, which is chapter 8. Okay, so chapter 6, Wide Green Prison. This is where the Bradfords show their true colours and sense of social superiority with that quick departure that they undertake to get away from the plague-ridden village. The arrival of Michael at the hall to try and talk the Bradfords into staying demonstrates Colonel Bradford's brazen arrogance about what his social obligations actually are as far as he's concerned. Michael actually tries to appeal to Bradford's better nature, as it were, when he says here on page 113, and while I am pledged to do my utmost to bring these people comfort from you and your wife and from Miss Bradford, the smallest gesture would mean so much more. Elizabeth Bradford stifles a snort, and Michael's rejoinder later on, when he says one does not have to be a priest to be a man, it's kind of insightful in terms of his own character and how he sees the world as well. Bradford's true colours, that he doesn't care for a few sweaty miners and their snotty-nosed brats, is appalling and just kind of breathtaking in its actual brazen disregard for anyone that's actually not of his family. And when Anna leaves the church that morning, right at the beginning of the chapter, she's talking about how it's almost as though the sermon's sort of lifting her along and carrying her. As she says here, I left the church that morning borne aloft by a strange bliss. But unfortunately, that grace that she sort of experiences is quickly done away with on page 115 at the top, when Bradford then turns around and says that the villagers may as well have some comfort since they have no choice. And essentially what that's doing is reminding Anna again. It's almost like she's had this little interlude of escapism, and that there's something greater out there that she's actually doing. And with Bradford saying that, it kind of brings the reality of her situation back home to her again. And she says, I had less than no reason to leave. The plague had already taken from me the greatest part of what I had to lose. What was left of my life seemed to me, at that moment, barely the effort worth saving. I realized then that I deserved no great credit for swearing I would stay. I would stay because I had small will to live and nowhere else to go. And that's, it's kind of a pathetic realization and pathos in its purest form. It's not pathetic that she's a ridiculous creature in sort of admitting that. If anything, it shows a strength of and an insight into her own kind of psyche at that point. Michael leaves the Bradfords with a sort of a heavenly judgment or curse on the family, a fear of far worse punishment than the plague, and then basically jumps on his horse and rides away, is something. It's almost like he needs to believe that the Bradfords will suffer for their decision, as though it's there's a heavenly right and wrong that will kind of come out eventually. We then sort of move on to, it goes back, the Bradfords leave. They basically get rid of all of their servants, even to the point where when they get to Oxford, they're actually going to get rid of their coachman, so the guy that actually drives the carriage. They're going to get rid of him as well. So there's nobody that they've actually taken with them. It's essentially just themselves, which is selfish and just such a breathtaking level. Anna is then, she sort of goes on to recount a little bit more about the boundary stone and the fact that it's like when you can't have something, you want it more. And so the boundary stone, when she says here that she would not normally sort of go beyond that maybe half a dozen times a year, but now that she can't, she wants to. It's interesting in terms of when you want something, you can't have it, and perhaps could be applied to sort of other things as well in the novel. So, for instance, Eleanor wants an actual relationship with Michael but can't have it. So whatever they want, they can't necessarily have. It's that earthly gratification of things that that they seem to suffer, these characters. We have Eleanor later on in the chapter. So from 119, she rushes out when they get back to the rectory. And Eleanor's waiting, and she actually takes Anna to the Daniels cottage because Randall Daniels' wife is in labour. And we get a small insight into Anna's, the brutality of Anna's childhood. We've had a taste already of, you know, the cruelty of her father. Now we get to see the vulnerability kind of laid bare in terms of the recount of her mother and how her mother actually died when she was four. And on page 120, she talks about how the surgeon, the barber surgeon, so a man of clearly multiple talents or skills, and I'm saying that in a really ironic kind of way, used a Thatcher's hook in order to open up her mother when she was four, when Anna was four, so that the baby that her mother was pregnant with could actually be delivered. Now, what I'd like you to do, if you haven't done it already, just Google what a Thatcher's hook looks like, and you'll get a really clear idea about the brutality of the medical profession at the time. Men and women very much saw childbirth and that sort of thing quite differently, and there was a fear and a brutality that quite often came from the men, whereas the women were very much, obviously, far more kind of in tune with childbirth and labour and pregnancy and things like that. So her mention of the Gowdies and the fact that there are no Gowdies left, and Eleanor reminds Anna that, you know, they're the only thing that, that she's actually got. Okay, so we've got here, Anna overcomes these fears, but then she's got her new one. So even though she manages to deliver the baby, and that Mary Daniels is someone that is able to kind of, she's young enough, she's strong enough, and she delivers this baby. And Anna shows a certain skill in this chapter that indicates later on that she has the ability to tap into a natural talent, but also the fact that she can hear Anna's whispering in her ear, but you do know, you can do this, Anna, use your mother hands, kind of links into a skill beyond sort of the natural skill that perhaps you might have just as a woman that's given birth herself. She manages to deliver the baby and it's intact, and she, there's a sense of pride, and they celebrate this childbirth. But the fact that there's a new life and she goes back to that lonely cold cottage of her own, and the taking of the file of Poppy from Eleanor's basket indicates that while she can kind of step outside her own grief and her own loss for a little while, it's not something that she's even started to wrap her head around yet. Okay, so I'll take a little bit of a break and we'll move on to So Soon to Be Dust. Okay, so Soon to Be Dust is chapter 7 of Year of Wonders, and it's interesting that she's now moving into more of a death kind of theme with the name of these chapters. So Soon to Be Dust, referencing the whole kind of temporality of the physical form, so that we actually have death kind of indicated in the chapter title before we even kind of get to the content of it. In this chapter, Maggie Cantwell dies. Now, remember, Maggie is the cook who was at Bradford Hall, and she was rescued by Brand. Now, they go into Maggie goes to a small village called Bakewell, also famous for Bakewell tarts, but you may not have actually seen them. Very tasty. Although the villagers of Bakewell probably didn't behave in a very fabulous manner in this respect. Maggie's beaten up, and she comes back to the village as though her face has actually been, it looks like a fruit pulp. And it says here, the description that Anna gives of Maggie's face is just kind of horrifying, actually. The right side of Maggie Campbell's face looked like a smear of clay that an impatient potter had likewise disfigured, while the left side, under the mess of dried-on fruit pulp, looked as vivid as ever. The right was a blur, the eye all but closed and seeping, the cheek drooped and the mouth a drooling sneer. Maggie strained to turn her head to take us in with her one good eye, and when she recognized me, she gave a sound that was half moan, half shudder, and reached for me with a flailing left arm. I would say that Maggie actually suffered something along the lines of a stroke, just by the description, and the fact that later on, Anna kind of talks about the fact that she had suffered another spasm, which kind of indicates that perhaps there is some sort of neurological damage as a result of this horrific incident where the villagers basically pelted her to drive her out. And the Bakewell villagers, you could say, actually also echo the fear and the thoughtless kind of reaction to the plague that the vigilante crowd had when they killed the Gowdies, or Annis at least. Michael's curse. Now, Anna actually says here on page 131, God damn the Bradfords. The words slipped out of my mouth before I knew I'd uttered them. Rector Montpellier looked at me. Interesting that she's calling him Rector there. Looked at me, but not with a rebuke I'd expected. Don't trouble yourself, Anna, he said. I believe he already has. Which is an interesting thing for him to say. I mean, it's part reassurance, but part kind of gives the indication that perhaps he's got some sort of extra knowledge that Anna doesn't. With this chapter, we also see Anna going to the Miner's Tavern in order to ask her father for something. Now, we really get an insight into not only his kind of routine, his position in the village, with the way that he actually interacts with the other guys at the tavern. We see the coarseness of his language, and we see the pleasure that he gets and the need for her submission as well, for Anna's submission. It's just horrific, actually, what he does. So Anna makes the mistake, actually, here of, you can see that emerging intelligence and need to kind of establish yourself as an individual away from him popping up in this chapter. So at the top of 133, where she says, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying. Now, these people, they're not the most learned group in the universe, but they certainly know their scripture and they've been to church often enough to recognize what she's actually saying here. So when one of them says, your whelp knows how to nip, basically your child, your daughter knows exactly how to get you and bring you down and emasculate you, he turns around and he pushes her down to kneel in front of him. And we get that sort of flashback of Anna again, where she sees her mother clapped in the branks. So basically what the branks were, she goes on to elaborate, the helmet that was attached to a chain that actually had her tongue held in place that he would yank on. And basically that was a punishment that she was suffering because she'd had the temerity to have a go at Joss. And when someone had actually taken off the branks, her tongue was so raw that she couldn't actually speak. So if you've ever seen someone with a swollen tongue, it literally filled her mouth and she couldn't speak, she couldn't eat, she couldn't do anything because her tongue was all sliced up and swollen. And she doesn't have, she goes on to say that Sam had gone and thumped Joss one, go Sam, when they were married because Anna had told okay, I'm not advocating violence, I'm just saying that, but you can understand Sam's reaction to going around and actually beating up Joss and knocking him flat in a blow, which I just think, yeah, richly deserved, for throwing, Anna told him a tale when she was six where her father had actually flung her against the wall and kind of broken something which hadn't set properly. The worst thing is that in the tavern, she's kneeling in front of him and she wets herself. She's so afraid that she reverts to this childlike state where she can't actually control the fear. He kicks her in the side and she is pushed over into the her own mess that she actually has got on the floor. And I just think he's cruel enough to actually take pleasure out of humiliating her so perfectly, as she puts it, my perfect humiliation. She runs home, she's soiled, she's shaking, she's weeping, she's absolutely humiliated, and goes home to change, and then Seth arrives at the door to take her back to look after Maggie, who eventually dies. Later that night, she actually dies. And it's a sobering thought. What it does is it gives Anna perspective so that she realizes that even though she's got an appalling father and she doesn't have control over her fear, and there are certain things that she actually doesn't quite know how she's going to live with, in perspective on what's going on around her, she realizes that it's actually unimportant in the big scheme of things. All right, so that's my very quick, basic summary of Chapter 7. And you're going to get another blast of brilliant music, and then we will get on to the Poppies of Leith. Okay, so we're now in Chapter 8, The Poppies of Leith, which it sounds weird, but this is probably one of my favourite chapters because it gives us such an insight into the very deliberate choice that Anna makes to have a life and to keep living and to see value in what's around her in such an explicit way. So the opening of the chapter begins with the fall. So it seems apt indeed to speak of the fall. So what she's talking about there is the fall of grace in the Garden of Eden. So again, we've got that linkage back to the whole idea of the apples from perfection to a state of eternal sin, essentially. And she's talking metaphorically about how do we tumble down a hill. So she's talking about her taking of the opium, but she's also using the metaphorical example of running down or falling down a hill, and all of a sudden we are gone, our body lost to our own control, until we find ourselves sprawled in indignity at the bottom. And what she's doing is she's foreshadowing the conversation that she's going to have with Eleanor later. There's a reference to Mem's skill and the introduction of exactly what the Poppies of Leith are, so the opium that Sam actually used when he was hurt, his ankle was hurt, and Mem Gowdy came around and set it. So she's got some idea of actually what this is, and she's had enough kind of experience now with trial and error with Eleanor to know what actually this is. The fact that it's a tawny resin, so if you can imagine, it's kind of like a dark, sticky kind of substance. It's not white, so the whole idea of opium and those opiates being white, in its purest form, it's like a dirty brown kind of colour. And so what she's done is she's cut it and she's coated it with honey and then swallowed it and waited for it to take effect. The city that she actually dreams about, the city was all white and gold, curving in a wide arc around a sea of sapphire, which is on page 138. Gives the reader an indication of where she's going to end up. So it's, though she chooses that destination partly by random, you could also say that perhaps what she's doing is she's unconsciously gravitating towards somewhere that she's had in her head for a long time. She sees her children, which is something that I think she's probably desperate for at this stage, and it's part of that grieving process. But the fact that she wakes up and she's again back in that lonely, cold cottage by herself, and she's stiffened up on the floor. So even though her spirit and her heart have been able to kind of fly free, her physical reality has been huddled up on a cold stone floor all night. And she's actually got the imprint on her face of where she'd actually been lying on the floor. The fact that her mouth was as dry as ashes and tasted as if I'd sucked a gall. So it's kind of like waking up with, not that you would know this, but a really bad hangover. And just that kind of, yeah, dryness, that dreadful dry mouth. She gets really addicted quickly. There's an element of panic that comes through when she can't kind of find it initially, find the rest of that tawny resin. She can't, and then she does find it. She's like, oh, okay, fine. She realizes that not only will she have another 10 hours of unbroken sleep the next night, whenever she chooses to use it, but it's functioning as her safety net. And she lacks emotional support, she thinks. So this has become, or becoming, her crutch. Fortunately for her, she's distracted by the death that she has to deal with. And it sounds really brutal, but she says herself that she functions better when she doesn't have to think about her own loss. It's almost like she can put her own grief aside and concentrate on those people that actually need her for this period of time. And unfortunately, it's the same day that Lib actually dies, and she can't make amends with her before she does die. And they've been on, their friendship's been out of joint ever since the vigilante crowd, and unfortunately Anna isn't able to put things right before Lib actually dies. She knows that after she has another night where she sleeps, and the idea of sleep being this form of escapism is beautiful to her. And she can't sleep without the opium, without the poppies. And she realizes that she's got a limited stock, basically, and as any addict knows, they have to sort of find a supply somewhere. So she actually decides that she's going to go back to the Gowdy's cottage, but gets distracted by Kate Talbot. Now, Richard Talbot is the local smithy. So he's the guy that does all the ironwork and the shoes for the horses and all of the ironwork in the village. And unfortunately, what he's done in his masculine wisdom kind of way has told his wife Kate, who's pregnant, that he wants her to lance the buboes on him, and she refused. And so what he did is he grabbed the iron poker and did it himself, and the description is just horrific. 144, she says, "As I had expected, the smell of rotten apples filled the house. That scent, once beloved, was now so married in my mind with sick rooms that it made me gag. There was another smell also in the Talbot house, the odour of burned meat left to rot. Richard Talbot, the strongest man in our village, lay wasted and whimpering upon his bed like an infant, the flesh of his groin singed as black as a roasted beef. The place where the iron had seared was laid open to muscle, seeping pus and green with putrefaction. Which I just... An iron, like a smoking hot iron poker, he has taken and seared this bubo that's filled with all this blood and pus. And so now you've got this decaying flesh, along with the infection that clearly would have been caused by this, plus the plague sore itself, and it's all just weeping green and pus, and it's just revolting. And again, she's got that smell of apples coming through, rotten apples. So it's both visual and on a smell front, an olfactory front, just like an instinctive gagging reaction. Unfortunately, what she also discovers when she gets to the cottage is that Kate has bought some form of supernatural charm, and was supposedly from Annis Gowdy's ghost. But then, as Anna reminds Kate, she says, it wouldn't be her, because for you know her cures were always practical things made of common earthly weeds and warts that she in her wisdom knew the health-giving use for. Throw that paper away, Kate, I said, and put aside these foolish, poisonous thoughts, for I am sure we will find someone of this village, corrupt and greedy, but very much alive, was the voice you heard in the windy night. And what she doesn't realise is that it's going to be someone a little bit closer to home than she expected. So Kate decides that she's going to get rid of charm, and then she continues up to the Gowdy's cottage. Now, we've still got the snow, and the fact that she's actually wading through the snow shows the level of desperation that she's actually at this point. She gets frightened when she gets there by Eleanor, who's actually out there gathering bits and pieces and doing some reading of the books that the Gowdy's have, and who'd lost track of time. But Eleanor also startles her into sort of blurting out the truth. And Eleanor is not someone that judges her. She actually says that having memories is a good thing, and I think that's probably something that no one's really articulated for Anna up until this point. She says to her, "But I cannot believe so. I think that God gives us these precious recollections that we may not be parted entirely from those he has given us to love. You must cherish your memories of your babes, Anna, until you see them again in heaven." And it gives her an opening to tell Anna her own story about the seduction of her when she was 14 by the son of a duke. So in terms of the social scale, a duke is, you know, almost near the top. Okay, so it's somebody that she was seduced by of importance. So then we get back to that whole kind of subtext about the nobility doing what they want, as opposed to giving a damn pretty much about anybody else. She was deceived as a girl. And if you've read Pride and Prejudice, I was reading this and it reminded me very much of what happened to Lydia when Wickham, she eloped with Wickham from Brighton and they ran away to London, and then Darcy had to go and find them. And it, again, the seduction of a young, innocent girl by a more worldly, uncaring older man, which might sound sexist, but actually happened all the time. Once a woman's reputation was gone, it was gone forever. And Eleanor tells us of her own self-punishment, which was, in a sense, self-mutilation and self... self-inflicted punishment with the poker, which was, as she says, desperate. And she says, "And I was deranged. I violated my own body with an iron fire." So she was pregnant. She was pregnant with the Duke's son's child, who refused to marry her. She was taken back to her father's estate, and she violated herself with a poker. But as a result, cannot bear children. So you get this thwarted maternal instinct that actually you can understand why she's so caring and mothering of the people in the village, and possibly why she's so well suited to be Michael's wife, because she is somebody that genuinely cares about the people in the parish, to perhaps her own health detriment as well. Michael was a friend of the family, so we get the backstory of how they met. He is somebody that, again, reminded me a little bit of Pride and Prejudice with how Darcy's father took Wickham in, educated him. But unlike Wickham, who turned out to be a complete cad, Michael turned out to be somebody that was good, who started off as Eleanor's friend and soon became someone that Eleanor was convinced could redeem her, would give her the ability to redeem herself and what she'd done, because the taking of the baby's life was a horrendous sin. And Michael had told her, from reading between the lines, that basically he gave her the means to redeem herself in that respect. We can see Eleanor's intelligence and methodical nature coming through in this chapter as well. So on page 156, we know that she's actually got the map and the starburst map that starts at Anna's cottage and spreads its way out. But she's also managed to kind of look at who's being infected and who's managing to stay healthy. So the very young and the very old are the first targets, apart from Margaret Blackwell, who seems to have some sort of natural immunity. And so what she's actually saying to Anna is, can you accept that I've done this? Can you be my friend without judgment? And do you think that we can work together to kind of resolve this and do the best that we can in terms of the natural remedy kind of program? And to Anna's credit, she takes Eleanor and you see a genuine blooming of the friendship, which up until this point perhaps has been uneven, but because Eleanor's opened herself up in terms of what happened to her, they're on an equal emotional footing now. And though Eleanor poses her the question at the end of the chapter and says, well, what do you think we should do with these poppies? You get the panic again. You get that thought where she says, although my thoughts had sped immediately to my own needs rather than those of the dying, she's got the, okay, no, I'm going to have to do this. I'll destroy them. So she puts them on the fire. But she also says here that she knows what to look for in the Gaudi's garden should she need it later on. And I think that kind of gives her safety net again. But she is, perhaps there's an element of realism that's creeping through when she says here, but then I realized that this was not quite true. There was our work. I had seen that afternoon how it was possible to lose myself in it. And yet this loss of self was not selfish oblivion. From the study and its applications might come much good. So if you go back to the whole idea of Michael's sermon and the and how he was saying that we're not doing this just for ourselves, we're doing this for the greater good, that we're doing this for the community and for God. Anna's doing this because it's actually going to be of more benefit to a wider range of people than just herself. So that's kind of she's at that almost crossover point in terms of her personal development, I think, in this chapter. Work's going to be her distraction, but it's also going to be something that will benefit her and the people around her. Okay, so I have managed to get this down under 35 minutes, which is actually quite an achievement for me, given that I love to talk, as you well know. I'm going to stop the podcast now, and the next podcast, I'll try and do 9, 10, 11, and yeah, we'll see how we go. So there's probably another couple of podcasts that will cover the book, and then we'll get onto like themes and characters and things like that. Okay. Catch you next time.